Welcome to Holistic Trauma Healing, a podcast that empowers you to heal trauma in the same way it has affected you as a whole person. I am Lindsay Lockett, your host. I have discovered a profound path to healing trauma that allows us to move out of the role of victim and into the role of empowered and conscious creator of our best possible reality. I offer hope, healing insights, and practical tips as you get to the root of how trauma has affected every part of your existence and how to weave a new web of life that isn't ruled by the past. Welcome back to the Holistic Trauma Healing Podcast. I am here with Catherine Quering. She is a licensed mental health counselor and self-trust coach who helps evangelicals learn to trust their desires and reconnect to their inner wisdom. She also helps people pleasers learn to trust themselves and recenter themselves at the helm of their lives. She loves this life-changing work of therapy and healing and feels so privileged that she gets to spend her days doing this. And outside of this work, Catherine is an avid podcast listener, book lover, paddleboard enthusiast, and toddler chaser. Welcome to the Holistic Trauma Healing Podcast, Catherine.
Thanks, Lindsay. It's so great to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's just dive right in. So we are going to have a conversation today that is revolving around religious trauma, which is a topic that I've covered on this podcast before, but it has been well over a year. So I think we're overdue to have another conversation about religious trauma. So everyone who listens to my show knows my background being raised in evangelical Christianity in the South, in the Bible Belt. So I grew up in the Southern Baptist church. And during the late 90s and early 2000s, the purity culture movement was sweeping through the United States, particularly in the South. And so when I was 12 years old, I signed my purity pledge, promising God and my parents that I would remain a pure virgin until I was married. And then just after that, things just went downhill from there. And it was like a lot of brainwashing, a lot of believing that my anxiety was actually my intuition, believing that the voice of God was not this like loving, peaceful voice that everyone described to me. My experience with the voice of God was this very anxiety-inducing, scary voice that was probably going to tell me that I needed to do all kinds of things that I didn't want to do in the name of being a good Christian. I was also extremely brainwashed as a woman to be this quiet, submissive, modest kind of wallflower doormat who always serves my husband and never complains about anything and gives him sex whenever he wants. So does it sound like we have some things in common?
I was going like, check, 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 pretty much everything.
Great. So what is your story with religious trauma?
I'm going to back up a little bit earlier than yours started with the like feeling like I needed to pray the sinner's prayer.
That definitely happened for me when I was eight. Yeah, that happened when I was eight.
Mm-hmm. So I also grew up in a large Southern Baptist church in the South. And the first sanctuary that we were in before it got to like mega church size was actually everything was red. The carpets were red, the pews were red, and we sang all the blood hymns. And so it was just like, I remember that being like, this is so strange that everything is centered around blood and Jesus's blood and all these songs of like Jesus's blood washes away all your sin, and that being really strange as a kid and foreign, and did not feel like a way of understanding or worshiping God. So that was just like a little piece of that that came up for me. But I remember feeling really intuitive, really self-aware, really connected to God and to my spirit when I was young, and being confused about some of the Bible stories and things I was being taught. But none of that felt particularly burdensome until there was this like outside evangelist that specialized in sharing the good news and air quotes with kids that came one day. And I remember the shock of what he was saying hitting my system, where like, I remember thinking, I thought I was connected with God. You're telling me I'm not. You're telling me I'm bad at my core and I'm sinful and I can't trust myself and I have to pray this certain prayer to be safe. And so I like scrambled down to the front at one of the, you know, Baptist altar calls. I was like, okay, well, I better do that. As soon as the shock wore off. And now, you know, as a trauma therapist, understanding that that is how, that is the essence of trauma, that level of shock and freeze and trying then to cope with that. And the way that I coped with it was I was very aware I did not live inside myself anymore after that. I called it sidestepping myself for a long time before I really understood it. I knew that I just was not living out of my core. And I was very aware that they were, I was living out of parts of me watching and managing myself to make sure I did the right thing, yeah. Right? All of those yeah. rules that you talked about, the good girl programming, the like purity, the obey your parents, the all the stuff that you're taught about how to be a good Christian in this framework. And it was so the opposite of life-giving. I'm trying to think of even what that would be called, right? Like it just kind of shut me down, right? And just became more and more burdensome. Mm-hmm. And another piece of my story was that it felt like there was a lot of pressure to be codependently attached to God. So I was like, you know, all in on that, right? And doing my devotions every day and doing all the checklist of things that they gave you to do. And feeling so afraid because of the fear in that system that if I did not feel close to God, or if I felt something like anxiety or shame or worry or sadness or fear or any of those things, right, that were said, this is not from God, that that meant I did something wrong. And I felt so overwhelmed and shamed and scared and like, okay, I have to fix it, right? Because there were all those messages around, you know, it, there was a particular phrase about like, well, if you don't feel God, guess who moved? It couldn't be God because God is perfect and always loving and always there for you, right? And can't be around sin. So if you're feeling something that doesn't feel like worshipful gratefulness to God, you did something wrong.
Yep.
Right. And yep. instead of it just being this one part of human experience to experience lots of emotions, and two, oftentimes the results of the trauma and the oppressive system that we were in and all the fear, right, that's bringing up these feelings that then we feel like we have to stuff down and squash. And kind of like you were saying before, building on that of like, I felt like I had to hide my feelings from myself and from God,
yeah.
right? Because I felt like, you know, there's so much language around God can see everything, knows everything, right? All the numbers of hairs on your head, all of that, that I felt like I had to hide from God, right? So there was like, I couldn't even be aware of my emotions internally and what I really thought and what I really felt, because that was really terrifying that God would know that. And then I would be separated from him.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And totally. I think for me, the focus was largely that relationship dynamic and like fear of abandonment and rejection and that kind of thing, as someone who's really in touch with other people's emotions and empathic and really worried about that. And I know there's lots of other people that then the next step of that was like the fear of torment and hell and the rapture. And like, that was also, you know, a whole nother layer of that, right? That was felt pretty intensely.
Yeah. There's so many things that you brought up, like the Baptist altar call, man, that is a whole, for those people who are listening, who are like not familiar with the Southern Baptist altar call, it is like a reckoning. It is like, it's so intense. And what you were saying about like the moment that you felt the shock and you were like running down the aisle to go pray the sinner's prayer, because what they were offering you at the end of the aisle was certainty about your salvation, your eternity, your goodness, your worth. Like at the end of that aisle, at the end of that sinner's prayer, was the prize of certainty that you could be sure that you were good and that you were going to heaven and God loved you if you did this.
Right. And I think it would have been different if it wasn't part of the system, my community that I was a part of, right? Yeah. If I was visiting another church and that happened, I would have just been like, that's weird.
Yeah.
You but know, like people this cognitive you trusted. Dissonance.
Yeah. 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 It was people you trusted and like your parents were there and your friends are there, right? Like, I remember that so much. Like, the only time I ever saw my friend's parents was at church. And like, when we would all sit in the same, we all had like our assigned pews, you know, like our family sat in the same pew, like every single Sunday. And our, my friend Jenny and her family sat right behind us in their pew every single Sunday. So I am curious, how old were you when you ran down the aisle and prayed that sinner's prayer?
7.
Okay. So I was 8. I was 8. And for me, it happened at Vacation Bible School. And I remember being in our sanctuary was all mustard yellow. So it was like mustard yellow carpet and mustard yellow pews. But my husband's church that he grew up in was the all red. Like exactly as you're describing, I'm like picturing my husband's church that he grew up in, First Baptist Borger, Texas. I grew up at First Baptist Canyon, Texas, and we had a mustard yellow sanctuary. But anyway, like I remember this white-headed preacher in a gray suit getting up in front of this sanctuary full of kids who were like there to color and eat goldfish and drink lemonade. And he like said this statement that I have the same feeling in my body that you describe in yours. And his question was, if you died tonight, do you know where you would go? And like,
right.
As an 8-year-old, I've never even considered this concept before. I've never considered my own morality or like the fact that there is like a place of eternal torment that I might go. Like I've never considered right. any of these things at 8 years old, but here this guy is like telling me that it's a possibility that I could die and not know where I'm going. So again, it's like offering that certainty, right? Like, oh, you don't know where you would go? Well, come down here because I can tell you how to get where you want to go. Right. But then once you pray the sinner's prayer, there's this checklist of things that you have to maintain for the rest of your life in order to be a good Christian girl. And like very similarly to you, it was like, I went from being this playful child who was in my body to almost being like outside of my body, constantly watching myself, waiting for myself to mess up, waiting for myself to sin. Right. I'm curious if you struggled. I struggled so much with this. And now I know that it was that I had this deep fear that I was never going to be good enough and worthy enough, but I struggled with doubting my salvation a lot. And so I like air quotes, recommitted my life to Christ multiple times, was rebaptized multiple times because I would lay in bed awake at night, afraid that the original sinner's prayer that I prayed wasn't enough, wasn't real, and my salvation wasn't actually certain. Did you have that as well?
I didn't personally, but it was because I was so codependent and worked so hard to please God. I was so rigid in what I did that I didn't have that fear, but I saw a lot of my peers.
Oh yeah, I was super rigid. I was super rigid. I just could never not have the fear. Like I was never rigid enough, I guess.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah. So interesting. So many parallels. All right. Well, I have some questions. First of all, before I jump into these questions, do you have a way that you can, I know it's a very nebulous, complex topic, but do you have a way that you can sort of define for our listeners what it is we mean when we say religious trauma?
Sure. So I'm going to start with just trauma, basically. And I know that you speak so much to our bodies and our nervous systems. And I think that's a really helpful way to understand trauma, that it's less necessary to understand what the abuse is and what the person did, right? Whether the intent was good or bad, that the way it enters your system is too much too fast and you can't, your body doesn't know how to process it.
Yeah.
And so your body reacts in one of various ways that we know our bodies react in trauma. So that's either fight, flight, freeze, or fawn or appease is the other one. And they don't mention as a part of trauma, but dissociation, which you talked about being outside of your body, is like akin to the freeze response, right? So anytime that you're not fully in your body or able to process through whatever the experience is or whatever happened, that is trauma in your body, right? So even these things that maybe to other people didn't feel abusive or didn't look like abuse, right, can be really traumatic.
Yeah, my absolute favorite, and I'm saying that with so much sarcasm, favorite comment that I ever get whenever I talk about religious trauma on Instagram is inevitably there's some person, usually female, who comes along and in the comments she's like, I'm so sorry. That was your experience of God and church, but that wasn't my experience at all. My experience of God and Jesus is that they are so loving and they would never reject you for any reason. And like, they just have this like very fluffy, lovey dovey, like comment that they leave. And I'm like, bitch, please, like this seriously harmed me and many other people.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, that kind of response is part of this fear-based system that we're in, that you can't even think that God would harm someone else, right? Yeah. So like that is their best attempt from being in that system to give you some compassion and kindness, right? But still, there's no ability to conceive that their conception of God or their way of relating to God might not be everybody else's, right? Or the way that like God actually is, you know, whatever the divine actually is. And I'm just going to add the religious trauma piece. So some people use like spiritual abuse was the term that lots of people used before. And now it's religious trauma is the one that's used the most. And it just means that the trauma happened in a religious setting and had the additional layer of God said this and dogma and religious systems and communities supporting that.
Yeah. So when did you leave the church or leave? Do you even still identify as a Christian?
I say I'm like Christian adjacent. So I think I'm like on the edges of maybe Christian mystic prophet to like maybe have some prophetic voice in the church to like outside of it. I'm really connected to Mother Earth and Divine Feminine and like eco-spirituality and learning from First Peoples. And that is where I find the most life. I haven't necessarily felt like if I had to abandon all of Christianity, but it, and like I still feel connected to Jesus. But the Bible really doesn't feel like something I want to read or care to study or feels like needs to have any authority in my life or even any like place in my life at all. Right. So, you know, I think there's pieces of that. My husband is a Presbyterian pastor, PCUSA church, and he actually helped me come out of conservative land. And so I appreciate his interpretation of things and was actually just like really honored. I got to speak at a Sunday school class last week and they really like listened to what I had to say, even though it's like out of the, like maybe their comfort zone or their margins. And I just appreciated that. So I guess anywhere I have space to be me and have all my spirituality and say what I feel like is my message is great.
So you're a pastor's wife.
I am.
Okay. I used to be a pastor's wife. Mm-hmm. And in the South, being a pastor's wife, like it would not be allowed for my husband to be a pastor and for me to be on the internet teaching about religious trauma from Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, does this like get in y'all's relationship and feel sticky sometimes? Or like, does it, I'm not familiar with like non-evangelical Christianity. So it's difficult for me to be like, whoa, you're a pastor's wife and you teach about religious trauma. How does this work?
I know. Yeah, and I'd say the congregation we're at, it's pretty diverse politically, but overall some of the like understanding of theology in the Bible is more progressive and more open and non-judgmental, and there's no focus on like your individual relationship with God and if you're doing the right things or like personal beliefs. There's not that same kind of introspection and puritanical kind of focus on that. That's like there's no guilt talk. It's more service oriented, and like we're a community trying to do good work in the world in the name of Jesus. And there's definitely like all the community stuff, right? That like people have their issues with each other. But I couldn't believe when we first came like 6 years ago, the young adult Bible study, they would read Waking Up White, and like even the like all the different Sunday school classes, like they're reading things that like I'm really impressed with. So I think there's definitely like good work being done there. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you go to church every Sunday?
Most Sundays, yeah.
Okay.
I have two little kids and 2 and 5, and thankfully like they feel super at home there and really accepted, and my goal is for them to feel really free there and not indoctrinated and not like shushed and quieted and like they have to be in a box, and so far they feel that way.
Good
So
job, mama.
yeah.
That's amazing. Okay. I had to explore that with you because my dynamic and experience as a pastor's wife was not what you are describing at all. So if you still go to church and you're married to a pastor and you still have some relationship with Jesus, how then did you get into this work?
It really came about from moving back to my hometown. And so we lived in Chicago. I lived in Chicago for a really long time, most of my adult life. And I just kind of kept shifting my perceptions of God there, right? To more loving, more space for me to be connected to myself and God. And that was just kind of like slow deconstruction work from the religious trauma. And then once I moved back home to the South, and the way Christianity shows up and the Christianese is just so reminded me of all my childhood stuff. I was like, okay, it's time to face this. I had like a lot of space from that before, and now it's time to kind of dig into that and be like, that still triggers me. What can I do about that? And it was interesting to me that it was like, oh, this is the heart of all that I'm passionate about coming home to self and working through helping people with sexual abuse, which is so similar to purity culture, and helping people with narcissistic abuse, which is so similar to like the toxicity of Christian evangelical culture, and like all of these things that I had been passionate about in my work as a therapist were like all wrapped up, or like had very similar pieces to religious trauma as I kind of was digging into it. And so that helped me heal, and then I really wanted to share that with others.
I love that so much. Such
Yeah.
a reclamation. For everyone listening, I also want to point out I caught this phrase. My listeners may not have, but you said, I recognized I was still triggered by that and asked, what could I do about this? And that is such a statement of personal responsibility, sovereignty, and agency that is absolutely necessary. Whether you're healing from religious trauma or any kind of trauma, right? Narcissistic abuse, sexual trauma, whatever, that piece of recognizing what it is that is so hard for you, and then having the agency and the power to choose what you are then going to do with something that was handed to you that you didn't necessarily choose. So I just wanted to like spotlight that for a moment because that is a necessary piece of the work. Is owning, here's what I'm triggered by, and I'm choosing to do something about it. So very beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So we touched on this a little bit in sharing pieces of our own stories, but I'm curious if you could kind of outline for us some of the ways that religious messages and religious pressure, especially if we were raised in that environment, leads to the disconnection from ourselves, from our bodies, from trusting ourselves. And it teaches us to outsource those things to God, the Bible, the church, like whatever. If you could elaborate on any of that, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'm just going to start with one of the trauma states that is really common that we experience is freeze and appease. So in a high control religious system, which is what we're talking about, there's not really room for you to live in your body or be yourself or listen to yourself. The only way to be okay in that system is to listen to what everybody around you and the leaders are saying is okay, right? And that can be named like the Bible, the Word of God, the pastors, all the people around you that are giving these very similar messages. And I have a whole course around that, around covert narcissism in religious settings and understanding it in that sense of, even if there is not a narcissistic leader at the helm, and even if everyone in the system's overt idea is their intent is good, right? It's to save you. It's for you to be close to God, like positive things for you. They are doing it using manipulation and power and control tactics because that's all that they know. And that's enforced and encouraged in the system.
Yeah. So and what are some of those control tactics that they're using? Like, can you spotlight?
Yeah.
Like we're just bringing awareness. We're bringing awareness to the disconnection and the distrust and disembodiment. But then we're also bringing awareness to not the individuals, but the system that is behind that and the messages that the system or the institution is perpetuating. So if you could highlight some of those, because covert narcissism, right? It's not obvious. Like, it's not something that many people would look at and be like, oh, yeah, that's narcissistic. So can you talk about some of those tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I was starting with that because that's what you're told you should believe and outsource yourself to. And then we can go to the distrust, like the specific messages about distrust.
Perfect.
So we're given this like ideological narcissistic leader and this and this narcissistic conception of God. So I'll start with the conception of God, which is God is all knowing. God is all good. God never changes. And there is no space to question, to explore, to consider anything else related to who God is, right? That is given to us as this given. And the only options we are given in relation to that are ones of authoritarian and patriarchy and like narcissistic worship. So we are supposed to adore, worship, submit, surrender, you know, be grateful, all of these things, right? That you would do to a narcissistic leader. And there's a lot of fear created around, we're supposed to have this absolute loyalty, right? And that's what narcissistic leaders need as well. And, you know, God or the divine or whoever, like, doesn't actually need that from us. But in these systems, that's what we're taught, right? And that we have to defend God. We have to defend God's word. We are God's ambassadors. It ends up being like God is a benevolent / tormenting slave owner, right? In the way that we're given who God is, right? Like, at best, we are his servants or his like chosen golden children or the scapegoat. And we are supposed to always be adoring, always be giving God the glory and the grace. And so if anything else happens, the blame goes to us, which is what happens with narcissists. The blame never goes to that person. The blame always goes to us, to our feelings. We have to, you know, contort ourselves or do whatever we need to do to get back to the place where we're adoring.
Yep.
Right. And there's the threat of rejection, shame, eternal torment, you know, all of these things if you don't do that. And along with that goes the, we always have to be in this subservient, dependent position, right? Like little kids. And that is another power and control tactic of infantilizing. I don't know if you have any other questions about the conception of God, and then I can move to like how that plays out in religious systems.
No, I don't think I have any other questions about that.
Okay. So some of the ways that plays out in the community is the sense where we are told we are supposed to look out for our brother, in quotes. And so instead of supporting, learning how to support and listen and with non-judgment to other people, we come to them with, I need to know if I consent or believe in what you're saying. So I know whether to confront you, whether to judge you, whether to like call you to conviction, right? Like we are always in this place of judging and then given a carte blanche to intervene in each other's lives, right? Instead of like humble, non-judgmental support. So that's one way. And that happens a lot, right? That happens in prayer groups, accountability groups, that happens just one-to-one. You know, then you have the whole purity culture thing of like, you have to be one certain way to be okay. So that's basically asexual. You can't live in a body or have any sexuality. You have to have pure thoughts. And this is not just sexual, right? But like any thoughts, pure words, pure behaviors, everything goes through this layer of like obsession with purity and virginal qualities and, you know, things like that, that just are absurd.
So absurd.
So there's that piece to it. There's all of the effects of internal tormentors and controllers and inner critics that get like layered into our internal worlds because of this, because that is the only way we're given to survive in this system is willpower, right? And contortion and assimilation. And so that's part of how you know it's a high control system too, that like, if you step outside of that, even by asking a really innocuous question, right? You're going to get shamed. You're going to get like the eye rolls. You're going to get all of the arguments of why you can't believe that and believe this instead about God. You know, that is just so interlaced in the culture where you can feel loved and supported, but only if you stay within this certain box.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love how you're like bringing this up from all these different angles, that it occurs. And one of the things that really sticks out to me is that God is like Santa Claus. Like he sees you when you're sleeping and he knows when you're awake and he knows when you've been bad or good. And so, like what that taught me was there's always someone watching me, judging what I'm doing, judging what I'm thinking, judging how I'm feeling. And so somehow I have to figure out how to get ahead of that and make sure I'm doing, saying, thinking, feeling all the right things so that this God, Santa Claus figure still loves me and still says that I'm good and worthy. And it's like, the paradox of it is that you're never, it's never enough. Like you're never doing it good enough. Like, and thank you so much for highlighting the sense of entitlement to like insert ourselves in each other's lives without consent and in judgmental ways, because I feel like that is one of the most damaging things about Christianity is that because you're in a community of people who all believe the same things, that that gives that community of people the free license to just speak into your life whenever they feel like it and say whatever they feel like saying. And if enough of them are like, no, this is what God's word means by this, and you're doing it this way, then you basically have to like bow down to their interpretation of the Bible, even. Like you're not even allowed to have your own thoughts or, you know, question the Bible. Like, I think that's another tool is like that this book is infallible and literal.
Right.
So yeah, so many different layers of that.
Right. Right. And system-wide, before we go to messages, you know, there's so many like systemic oppressive legacies that become a part of that, right? So there's like the legacy of the doctrine of original sin. And there's the Enlightenment dualism of the head is over the body and over the matter, right? That's laced in there. Then there's like white supremacy and patriarchy and divine discovery and all of these systems that are supported by this religious institution, right? Yeah. And laced with
substitutionary
it, right?
Atonement.
Exactly.
All of it. Yep.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So that is a lot of what we're experiencing in religious language.
Yeah. Do you see, I'm curious, because I think there's more evangelicals or ex-evangelicals than we realize, but I also think that there's a lot of people who have never identified with any kind of Christianity or who maybe identify with progressive Christianity or like very loose definition of Christianity or like whatever it is. But I think it would be really interesting if you could maybe talk about how this system, this institution of evangelicalism has infiltrated even non-evangelical and even non-Christian spaces like in our society. And like, I'll go first, like judging the way a woman dresses, I feel is rooted in the evangelical Christian mindset, because there's this, you know, modest is hottest, and like you're as a woman, right, you're responsible for other people looking at you. And if they think bad thoughts when they look at you, then that's somehow your fault. And like, there's a lot of non-Christian people who have this value of dressing modestly because of shame. And they don't realize that it may not even be rooted in like their own, like how they were conditioned outside of like their parents or their school or something, that it's like society at large has been influenced by evangelicalism. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I'm going to take that back even farther, because I think as I've been studying this, I mean, back to the earliest church fathers, Augustine, Tertullian, like all of these people that are widely respected for their theology, the things they were saying about women are awful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the whole idea of women as temptress, and it goes back to the founding of when Christianity started becoming an institution that was laced into it. And then I think our particular way of experiencing that is really informed by Puritanism and this, the level of like piety and like control over feelings and behaviors and dressing, right? And I would say also like caste system, right? Of like only, right? Because then like only women who dress modestly in a certain way are a certain level in this caste system, right? And people who don't, then we label as whores, right? And you know, you can think about it that as like archetypes, like Jungian archetype site. You can think about how that's been used in narratives about us and about our worldview and things like that. I think the evangelicals really picked that up as one of their like obsessions, I would say. And
they're really good at it. They're really good at it.
And so, you know, I don't think it started with them, but I think that that is something that so much of their belief is built on and reacting to. Like so much of the cultural stuff right now, it's not actually about Christianity at all, right? It's about these mores and values and ways of being that are obsessed with sexuality, right? That like there's only one way to express that, and anything outside of that is really terrifying, and it needs to be controlled, right? This whole idea of control versus support and openness and connection, and that ends up being like with sexuality too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much Christians control
their sexuality, right?
Like, yeah, it's like amazing how much Christianity is in our bedrooms. It's crazy. So back to the bigger question that we asked earlier that we still haven't gotten to is the messages. Yeah. So yeah, I'll give you space and stop interrupting with all these different tangents.
I know. So some of them are the like assumption that I am bad, right? That comes from these verses like Paul in Romans about there is nothing good in me. Everything I have is from God. In my flesh, there is nothing good, right? Starting that whole dualism of mind and body. And that extrapolates to like, I'm bad, right? There is nothing good in me. The only good thing I have is from God. The next level of that is I'm a sinner. And so then what do I need to do within the system to deal with that? And that's to manage my sin nature, right? We are never given any hope that that changes. And that is expressed over and over and over in the verses and in the Christianese and in the songs that we sing, like pleading for God to change us, pleading for God to fill us, right? That is the only way we're given in relating to God is us being like, you know, like come that fount of every blessing. It's like prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Lord, I feel, you know, like you have to keep me. Otherwise I will wander away, right? That is such a core part of this type of Christian message that like, I will deceive myself. I will always deceive myself. And so I cannot trust myself. I have to trust God. I have to trust the system that tells me how God is. And I have to trust these other people to keep me accountable because I cannot trust myself. Yeah. Right. And then we're given these additional messages of like, you can't trust your feelings. You can't trust your body cues. Like exactly what that looks like. You can't trust your thoughts. You need to control and harness them. You can't, you know, and so you end up being this controlled little robot, right? And you're divorced from your own sense of not just being your body and being in your body, but the way that your body can tell you what's safe and not safe, what's good for you and not good for you has been warped. So that's another part of those power and control tactics is the gaslighting and controlling reality, right? That this interpretation we're given of our own bodies, body cues, emotions, and thoughts are so twisted, right? That instead of them being information for us to understand, ways for us to process what's happening in the world, and ways for us to know how to keep ourselves safe, they're weaponized against us and taken away from us in a sense, right? Yeah. And so part of the work of healing is learning what it actually means to be a human and reclaiming that, right? So reclaiming our thoughts, our emotions, our body cues, our bodies as safe, and our desires as well, right? That like all these things are really necessary and helpful to us. So it's a lot, those are kind of the biggest pieces of that. And then there's also this sense of like, you're not even allowed to have a self, right? You're told to like hollow yourself out and let God fill you.
Yep.
Right. That you're supposed to be this empty vessel, this empty shell. And not just that, but like then poured out constantly.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's no boundaries. Just pour yourself out for the Lord and for his work. Always be self-sacrificial, like all of that kind of stuff. Which is just so detrimental to mental health, well-being, and right.
The saviorism,
anxious and depressed. And
yeah. There's so much saviorism. Like the saviorism is like hardcore. Like, and you're not pleasing to God if you're not out trying to save everybody all the time.
Right.
I love that you were quoting some scriptures. So a scripture that sticks out to me a lot is, "The heart is wicked above all things. Who can know it?" Mm-hmm. And like, isn't that so sad that we teach children to memorize Bible verses that tell them that their heart is wicked and they cannot trust it?
Exactly. Yep.
So harmful. Right.
And that the fear of God is the beginning of all wisdom, not our internal world. Right.
Yeah. And a gentle and quiet spirit is pleasing to the Lord. Like gentle and quiet is the only way that you can be pleasing to the Lord if you're a woman.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it makes us be smaller and smaller and smaller. And I can even remember being in prayer groups and with groups of people and being like, God, make us smaller so you can be bigger. make me smaller so you can be bigger. So it's like, we're praying that on ourselves, that I am praying that I won't take up space so that God can take up all the space.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. It's so, so fucked up.
Yep.
So yep, for a person who's, you know, my deconstruction journey was like years long. And I would say in many ways, there's still parts of Christianity that I have not yet deconstructed. And I don't go to church anymore. I don't identify mm-hmm. as a Christian anymore. I would say that I am deconstructed and deconverted. I am a very spiritual person. I will say the word God if it's appropriate, but to me, that doesn't mean the God of the Bible. That means like the higher power of everything that is the universe, universal consciousness, source. Mm-hmm. Like that's what God means to me now. It doesn't mean the God of the Bible. But I think the biggest way that evangelicalism still impacts me to this day, and I'll be 40 in 2 weeks. And the biggest way that it affects me still is there is still so much tenderness and shame around my own sexuality. Mm-hmm. Even though I've been in a committed relationship with my husband for 21 years, both of us still struggle with expressing ourselves sexually, using our voices, asking for what we want, trying new things, like even feeling sexual is difficult. So that's why I say I'm like mostly deconstructed, but there's still this one thread that kind of hangs on. But the process of deconstruction for me was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life, because for me, for a while, I held on to that certainty that if I just believe that Jesus died on the cross, I will be saved and I will go to heaven. Mm-hmm. If I just read my Bible and pray and do a devotional every day, then mm-hmm. I will please God. If I just submit and stay quiet and stay gentle, if I just am a Proverbs 31 woman, like it was. And so deconstructing from all of that meant for a while, it was like I was letting go of pieces of certainty. It was like trickling out of me. All of the certainty that I had was like leaving me, and there was nothing there to fill it again, because I didn't, I wasn't resourced in myself yet. Right. And I guess that's where I'm going with this, is that the codependent relationship that the leadership of these institutions perpetuates is one that, like, it's literally like sewing pieces of fabric back together that have been ripped apart to try and find yourself again.
Right.
Like it's so hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard. So how can we learn to trust ourselves again and to hear our intuition and our internal messages? How?
Yeah, right. And I think it is a process, and it's a reiterative process, right? That like you've done so much of that work, and then you're like, okay, this is the next layer, right? Of like full embodiment and sexuality, right? And so we keep getting deeper and deeper, right? Or higher and higher, however you want to think about that. So my framework for working through it is reflecting on the messages and the system, so you understand where the hurt came from enough, just enough to understand it. Don't want you to like live in it, right? Enough to say, I don't actually, who is this benefiting? And is this true? And do I need to believe it? And once you're out of it, why does it still hurt? Why am I still having some of these beliefs and triggers like inside, even though I know I'm away from that? So, you know, I named some of those, right? But like, I'm a sinner, I'm a bad, like this, that our core state is bad, right? Instead of, and then being able to say, okay, can I move to like my core state is good? And what does that mean? And how do I do that? So just the first piece is reflecting on those messages, then releasing any ones that don't serve me anymore, right? And some of that is sometimes is just a beginning of permission of I can start being willing to let these trickle out and let them go, right? I don't have to shove them out, but I can start that process of releasing and then reconnecting to self, which I do think, like you were saying, is the most important. And I have been trained in internal family systems, and I've done my own therapy through internal family systems. And that to me has been the most helpful way of connecting with self and having that kind of framework for humanity, for our humanity and understanding ourselves. So I'll go into that a little bit more, but that's part of what I mean by reconnecting to self. So that means, you know, like embodiment, knowing my core self is good, having a secure relationship with myself as opposed to this codependent relationship with God or with the church. And that's my returning to my own internal compass and myself. And then reclaiming any parts of me that got lost along the way, right? Like reclaiming, I can be a sexual being. I can be wild. I can be strong. I can have a voice. And also going to the parts of us that helped us survive in those systems and having compassion for those parts when we're ready and saying like, thank you so much for helping me survive. And now can you release those burdens and come have a different place in my system and in my inner world that is regenerative and restful for you and for all of us. And then being able to reemerge feeling more whole, grounded, and trusting yourself. And within IFS, the idea of the core self is just so revolutionary that it is basically the like sacred internal essence or part of me that anytime I am aware of having compassion, clarity, creativity, confidence, courage, choice, connectedness, I'm accessing my core self. And that part of me gets to be my new attachment figure. It's my highest, wisest self. It gets to take care of all these other parts of me that have been hurt and been trying so hard to protect me and say like, hey, we can do it a different way. Like, can you come join me in this? And that is kind of the essence of this healing relationship with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the more and more we unburden these other parts, the more and more self-energy and self-leadership we have, are the words that IFS uses. And the more we're aware of that and living in that energy, we're connected both to ourself and the like universal sacred. And just there's so much a greater awareness of that, and calm and clarity and connectedness is pretty incredible. So that is the heart of my spirituality at this point and my connectedness. And that's been my biggest grounding point and has been the most healing for me.
That's really beautiful. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you wanted to make sure you said today that you haven't had a chance to say yet?
Just if there's anyone, you know, listening to this that would like more support around it, I have like some free quizzes and programs, and then I have a couple courses that go through this, how to learn how to trust yourself again and recognize the harm of the systems that you came from. And I was even working this morning on one that's just kind of explaining a little more about IFS and how that works so people can start understanding that. So I have a kind of wealth of resources that people can access, and then, you know, one-to-one coaching and group coaching.
Nice. Yeah. So we're going to link to your Trust Yourself Masterclass because that is free. So we'll put that in the show notes. And then you have your group program, Trust Yourself Again, which is reclaiming your inner compass after leaving evangelical subculture. And then there's one more thing. You have your other course, Covert Narcissism and Religious Culture. And you mentioned that earlier. So, since you did mention that one specifically, and we talked about some of those covert narcissistic ways that the church infiltrates us, is there anything else that people should know about that course?
Just it walks you through like, what is narcissism? What is covert narcissism? What do I mean about this as like a person versus a culture? What are the specific tactics, like in the ways that you see these used in religious settings, then understanding each of those tactics, and then what does it mean to find a safe space and what does that look like? Because even in other spiritual settings or communities, you can find these tactics being used, right? And so how do you find safe spaces for yourself? And I do have a free quiz that goes with that too, that you can start with. It's just like exploring, have I experienced covert narcissism in religious settings?
Good stuff. All right. Well, we are going to give our listeners $25 off your covert narcissism and religious culture course. So I'll have a link for that in the show notes, and our listeners can use the code Lindsay with an EY, not an AY, an EY, for $25 off that course. I'm going to be checking that out myself. And thank you so much for being here today, Catherine. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome.
It's been a while since I've had a conversation with an ex-evangelical. It's always refreshing to have these conversations.
Yeah. And just to clarify, you can use that coupon for the other course too, to trust yourself again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. So either one of your courses, you can get $25 off with the code Lindsay. Amazing. We're going to link to that in the show notes. I appreciate you so much for being here, and super happy that this episode is going to reach a bunch of people who are deconstructing, deconverting, trying to figure out the mind fuck that is evangelicalism.
Right. Yep.
All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lindsay. I really appreciate it.